And now, our main speaker, all the way from Aliso Viejo, Wendy T.
Hi, my name's Wendy. I'm an alcoholic. And it's really good to be here. It's good to be sober tonight. And I want to thank Annette for asking me to participate in my sobriety. Kind of keep my mind out of, why I'm here. Just say yes, suit up and show up. I am from Aliso Viejo. That is a 4.5-hour drive. Just proves that I am willing to go to any lengths to hear myself talk. It's really good. I have a lot of friends here. We met for dinner, people that I've known from a couple different times I've been up here. And, oh my God, the sexiest man right here, Craig, my friend. It's good to see you. Just had a very lewd conversation about his spinal rehab. Which is, you know, the sign of a good friend. And, Kit, you did a great job. That was awesome. Thank you so much. I got to tell you honestly, though, I was a little disappointed. You were talking about making your... You got up to a place where you were talking about, going to jail for the sake of making an amends and cleaning up wreckage in your past in sobriety, which I so identify with. And then you said it was for exhibitionism, which just set my heart leaping. And then you went on to say for motorcycle speed. And I was just like, oh. So just a little... It's a little constructive criticism. Leave off the last two words. We don't need that. Okay, so, again, Wendy, alcoholic, and statistics. I am 51 years old. My sobriety date is August 10th, 2003. My home group is the Do It Sober group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Laguna Hills. Meets every day of the week at 7:30. If any of you are down in my area, please look me up, talk to Annette, get my number. I'm happy to take you. And... I have a sponsor, and I am sponsored, and I sponsor others. I am part of that connective kumbaya chain that we embrace here. That is not how I got here, with any interest on being close to, near you, or talking to you at all. On what people I had exposure to, I was done. And even with those that I had exposure to, I had no ability to share honestly what was happening in me at all. I didn't have examples of people who felt or reacted to life the way I did. So my responses to you were what I thought I was supposed to do or say based on TV shows or other friends' interactions, or I just had a very still deep in the cave experience with my fellows. And and for a very long time, when I've gone through dark spells, just can't see it getting better. Just can't see my ability to form a true partnership with another human being getting better. So, my job is to share it from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I do my very best to share with you honestly what it is that I've done a day at a time, not what I'm going to do or what you should do. I share my experience, my strength, my hope to the best of my ability, and I do that because I believe very firmly with the 16 years of experience I have here, that is the only way an alcoholic can hear it. If you're an alcoholic of my variety and someone comes at you with a, do it this way, missy, I wanna run the other direction. And I don't only wanna run the other direction, I wanna hurt you in the process of running the other direction. And so if I tell you, hey, this is what happened to me, and you think, hey, that happened to me, and I say, hey, this is how I felt, and you say, hey, that's how I felt, then my hope, my wish, just like it says on the inside cover of the big book there in the preface, is that you might jump to the conclusion that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you also. Because I genuinely, from the bottoms of my toes to the tip of my head, I truly have a life that is beyond my wildest dreams today. And it's not that it's beyond my wildest dreams in that it looks the way my wildest dreams would have been. My life is incredibly comfortable, but it's a small, simple, easily manageable day-to-day existence that with your help, it's incredibly enjoyable. And I enjoy being alive. It was not like that when I got here. When I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, they asked me to examine my relationship with alcohol. And it was difficult, you know, because it sounded to me like what you guys did was, because I have a tendency in my mind to group you as one entity. Yeah, the AA people, it sounds like what happened is they started drinking at 9. They would pull a handle of vodka, a gallon or something like that, a day from that day forward till getting here in their late 20s, early 30s. They're homeless. They're pushing a shopping cart. They roll into Alcoholics Anonymous. They're mean. They're angry. They have a knife in their boot. They've been to prison several times. And eventually they get a commitment. They get a sponsor. They do this thing. And by the time they're a year sober, they're full of fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. They're doing absolutely everything they're directed to do. Everything their sponsor says, and they're sponsoring others, and they're in the middle of this thing, and they're living the AA life, and they meet, you know, Mrs. Somebody. The girl meets boy on AA campus occurs. They have a family. They buy a big house. They open a business. They're thriving millionaires, and then they sponsor half the room. That's what I heard, you know. But I knew my truth. I had a drink, my first drink of alcohol. I was about 6 years old. My dad had taken me hunting in rural Pennsylvania, where we're from. And, you know, I'm six, and he grabs his daughter and a military-grade archery set because a gun would be unfair or something. He's dressed in camo, and he's got a six-pack of Coors Light with him. And I remember asking, you know, I want the adult beer. I want the forbidden fruit. I want, you know, the sip. And he gave me a sip. I either knew I couldn't ask for a second, or I just didn't care about a second. I don't remember obsessing about a second. And I also did not end up in the gutter with a brown paper bag the very next day. Fast forward, maybe I'm 8 years old. My mother's going through a phase where she thinks her kids should be a little bit more international, a little more cosmopolitan. She starts watering down the wine at the dinner table and gives me a sip of wine. Now I'm excited again. I get the forbidden fruit. I'm drinking the adult beverage. I get it. I'm not supposed to have it. I'm special. My mother has evolved. You know, you're all beneath me. But I don't want it again anytime soon. My parents get divorced when I was 8 years old. And I'm already an overweight kid. I'm already the kid that is constantly daydreaming and fantasizing about somewhere else. I'm already the kid that's, I want to be somewhere else with different parents and just know different people. And I'm constantly in that state of restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. I'm restless. I'm not settled anywhere. I'm irritable. You're not doing it right. I'm discontent. I need more wherever I'm at. I'm already that kid. My parents get divorced, and my mother decides that she's going to go off and finish her degree in dental school. And she did that because she cared so much about us. It was important to her to be able to support her daughters and be a good example. That was the fact. The feeling was my mother just threw me away. And I roll with feelings. I don't roll with facts. And go to live with my dad, and my dad is an amazing father. He, you know, pays for all of the, you know, the flute lessons, and he goes to all of the school recitals, and he makes sure that he covers my $500 expense from embezzling money from the Girl Scouts when that happened. And he's a good dad, but I start running away because, you know, I want to be with my mom. He's the ugly stepchild, you know, parent, and all I want to do is be with my mom. And I start running away, and he gets really scared. He is afraid I'm going to end up somewhere where I get hurt. And he says, you know, go live with your mom. And so now I'm 13, and I'm living with my mom, where she hadn't quite passed the dental boards yet. So she's kind of like a poor person and living in a one-bedroom apartment. But we're in Beverly Hills, below the tracks. And I am, at that point, at 13, I am 250 pounds. I am fuchsia pink hair. I am, you know, constantly in a state of fantasy. I'm incapable of speech with anyone directly, and I have no way of telling you what's going on with me. I can barely look people in the eye. I am so ashamed about the fact that I feel like an Amazon woman in this sea of 98-pound blonde-haired, blue-eyed beauties in California. I am asked to go get a gym uniform for my gym class in eighth grade. So I go to the store to get the gym uniform, and this is at a time where it's the 80s, you know, and they ask us to get these little dolphin green shorts for gym class, which was child abuse. And they don't have a plus size section, and the fact that they don't have my size is a shame I can't express. All I know is that my solution to my problem, and my solutions are usually worse than my problems on my own management, and I decide I'm just not going to go to gym class. So I start walking off campus, and I head home at 2 o'clock when gym class is supposed to start. And I remember, like, one of the first few times, I make it back to my little latchkey kid apartment, and I go to the one little cabinet, you know, in the house where my mother actually entertains with liquors, you know? And it's not like, you know, it's just a tiny little cabinet with, like, five bottles. There's, like, Frambuie, Drambois, Triple Sec, Gin, Midori. I mix them all together, and I take the top of each bottle, fill it back up with water, and I down it in a tumbler and throw it back with some bread because I didn't want to barf it back up. It did stay down long enough, but not entirely the whole night. And I remember some neighbor found me passed out on the floor because I'd never shut the door or something like that. I mean, there were consequences, but I didn't care. That was the first time. I was alone. There was nothing social about it, and no one had taught me to do that, but it took me a really long time after I got here to map that behavior as an obsession of the mind, because I didn't see the allergy immediately. I saw, you know, 6, 8, you know, and now I'm 13. Like, that's hardly a daily drinker, you know. That, do I really have a problem, you know? But I do know when I needed the solution, I sought the solution, and it was there, and it worked the way I needed it to work. There was nothing, I cared about the taste. I don't care about people, you know. But I did, the next day, share my experience, strength, and hope with my fellows in the parking lot. I grabbed the corner kids who were, you know, smoking cigarettes with, you know, Knox gelatin mohawks and, like, the all kinds of makeup, boys and girls, and, like, chains around their neck and TSOL t-shirts. And they, you know, started talking to me. And they invited me to go do other things. And I never had any intention to do other things, but they were my friends, and I had to be there for them. And so high school was kind of like that. High school starts off and it's just kind of like, you know, it's drinking. I found a way. I can't say it was like great at first. It was a way, you know, and it was a solution. And then we started, then there's huffing things and then there's, you know, fancy, funny cigarette things. And then there's, and then boys came into it pretty quickly after that. And I got to tell you, that was a brush fire. That was a brush fire in my home. I mean, they talk about here the God-sized hole, which is just a wee bit creepy in my mind. But for the sake of expressing it, like, there is just a black hole, an unending, insatiable need for some sort of solution on the outside of me, or at least that's how it manifests for me. It can manifest in that I need to get drunk, I need to get high, I need to find him, I need to get something else to eat, I need to more things, I need more. I am restless, I need different parents, you know what I mean? I need to be, the grass is greener on the other side, not where I'm watering it. I'm irritable, whatever you are saying, it's not right. I have no idea what right is, but it's not right. And I'm discontent. This just isn't enough, no matter what's going on with me. And so I find boys, and it's, I don't care if he's, you know, cute or he's yours or he's, you know, married or whatever's going on. All I know is he validates me when he looks at me, and that's all the power I want from you. I'm not like out dating guys, like writing them birthday cards and going, oh, I'm thinking about you. I hope you're well. I mean, How is your family? Like, not a conversation I'm having with anyone. I don't care. It was about me. It was about validating me. And then I jump in, because I could get more boys, I found, or at least I thought, well, I was right, if I lost weight. And I lost weight through just being completely abusive to myself. And then I started needing new clothes, and so I started stealing money from my mother, and then I started stealing money from my father. And the solutions, the bad choices for the way to live, the way to cope in life, begot five other bad choices. And I had just this cacophony of living skills that were so shameful and so embarrassing that I had the sense of impending doom, impending poverty, impending sanity, impending I'm about to be celibate for the rest of my life. You're a piece of shit. They're all going to know. So junior year, I see a flyer, and I developed like the apex of solutions for living, which is taking a trip. I see a thing for become an exchange student. And so the next year I was in Venezuela for a year as an exchange student. And I got there, and it really was, I was living with this beautiful family. She was a nurse, he was a liquor distributor. And they had three beautiful girls that all went to Catholic girls' school. And I just remember thinking, I'm going to throw it into fifth gear. I'm going to as hard as I can. It was my first attempt to stop. I'm going to do whatever I can to be as perfect as I can so I can have those real good friends they show with the girl with the pretty girls on the cover of 17 magazine. Because I really believe that was real. I want the blush print patent leather shoes that match the purse, you know. I want to look like, you know, a dignified, clean girl. I don't want to look like the piece of filth I've been living like. I don't want to be this person. And so I, for about 4 months, I throw it into fifth gear, and I'm just going to not drink and not drink and not drink and listen to everything I can in my Catholic girls' school and learn Spanish and be a good person. And what's happening is, on the outside, if you're another person looking at me, is that I'm becoming more and more miserable, more and more sullen, more and more sulked out. Like, I'm not only not eating, drinking, smoking, everything that I can find for that sense of spirit that I'm lacking, that hole that's that just a cave of wind in my soul. What I'm also doing is not talking, because I don't speak Spanish at all. And so I don't even have that connection with another human being. And so Christmas rolls around, and we're at this, we're at a party at the governor's mansion, or a friend of the governor's, whatever. Fancy guy, big house, a lot of really important people were there. The father of the family, I was very impressed. I'm in the corner in the back room on this very fancy leather couch, and I am, you know, 130 pounds and, you know, just a sucked up dish rag of a teenage miserable girl. And I'm not talking to anyone. And now, meantime, there's dancing going around. There's food. I mean, it's like amazing. It's just like this Catholic parade outside where they're throwing the confetti eggs, and there's iridescent, like, you know, building size paper mache Catholic figurines being paraded down the main street. And then there's, you know, trucks with house-sized speakers just booming salsa and merengue, and then there's the smell of smoke from barbecue all over the place, and the kids are dancing with the old people, and the old people are dancing with the kids, and there's teenagers having a great time, and it's just this amazing party. And me, completely not talking to a soul, just, you know, not eating, not drinking, not throwing up, not screwing anybody. I'm just gonna sit here and I'm going to be a good person. And someone comes by with a tray of rocks glasses with rum and coke in them. And I take a rum and coke glass, and it's kind of like, I didn't even occur to me. When they talk about, you know, he's like, well, wouldn't a shot of whiskey be nice in my milk? I'm just kind of like, oh, I totally understand that mental blank spot. I totally know it. I did not think twice. I, with everything in me, had not months ago, through the pain of getting there and feeling so incredibly inferior to everyone else around me. I mean, I grab that glass without a second thought, and I take a sip. And the minute I sip it, I know it's in there. I know the booze is in there, that feeling, that burn, you know? And my head starts spinning, and I'm just like screaming at myself with no one watching. And I can't even imagine what it looks like on the outside. But I'm just like screaming at myself, you're only gonna have one, you're only gonna have one, you're only gonna have one, you're only gonna have one. And I'm making this commitment to myself because I know it's gonna go bad, that I'm never gonna be this person that could have these people who I loved in my life the way I was living. And I know I'm just gonna have one. At no point, and I wish I could say that was this is the first time I was aware of it, but that experience, I must have gone through it 15 other times later on, where I'd like gone through some period where I was gonna not drink, and then I went on to drink again. So I have that first drink, And I'm talking to myself, and I'm like, you're only gonna have one, you're only gonna have one, you're only gonna have one. And it's, if at no point does it ever occur to me, just put it down now. I mean, because, you know, why? I mean, so I'm only gonna have one. And it's like the me now is trying to push forward with all my willpower to the Wendy at the end of the drink. Wendy, you are not picking up another drink. Like, I'm screaming at myself. But you get to the end of the drink, and I just remember thinking, that chick was uptight. I mean, it's really not that big a deal. It was like I made a contract with future Wendy, and when I got to future Wendy, past Wendy had left the building, so the contract's null and void. I don't need to worry about it. I'm going to move on to the next drink, and then the third drink. And then I just about third drink in, I was just kind of like, I speak Spanish pretty good, actually. I started having conversations with people that were around me, and they were laughing, but not at me, with me, kind of a thing, and helping me out with words. And then it kind of occurred to me that, oh, that's how you learn. You tell people what you believe it is, and they help correct you. They help course correct. And I wish I would have carried that forward with me. That was a lesson that I had to learn again when I got here. And I mean, that's, for me, at the heart of everything that AA is, you know. Wherever two or three are gathered, there he is in the midst. I got to let you know what's going on with me for it to pass through him. And it's that whole spiritual triangle, and it doesn't work elsewise. You know, I've got to tell everybody everything. And I'm that chick that shares a lot in meetings, if you don't know. So I, you know, by the time I'm five drinks in, there's some guy spinning me around the dance floor, salsa, merengue, the whole thing. And I'm convinced I'm meant to be Latin by that point. And next morning I come to, and I, you know, it wasn't a bad night. I didn't embarrass myself. I didn't, you know, make a scene. I had a great night. People seemed to be really happy that I was having a good time. They were grateful to get to know me because creepy girl on the couch hadn't been talking, you know? And we had a good time. So the next morning, I remember I said to myself, you know what? I'm just going to enjoy the holidays while they're here. And then when I have to go back to Catholic girls' school on January 4th, after the holidays are over, I'm going to just, you know, throw it back into fifth gear. I'm going to sit up straight and fly right, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to drink. I'm going to cross the T's and dot the I's. I'm going to be the girl that I want to be. And in 3 weeks' time, I come to you on January 4th. I go to put on my little Catholic schoolgirl uniform, and I gain 40 pounds, because that's how I roll. And I throw the skirt down because I'm just too embarrassed. I don't have, you know, I don't have the words to express that or even say that I don't have a skirt to wear to school today. And I go put on some sweatpants, and I go and meet the boyfriend that I'd acquired in the previous 3 weeks from the wrong side of the tracks, who was 11 years older than me. And we proceeded to break every rule of my exchange student program and just kind of flip our fingers at the entire process. I mean, I spent really the last 6 months or so of my program in and out of bars, running amok all over, you know, Venezuela, and making a bad name for the family that I was living with. And I mean, they were worried at first. They're kind of coming at me and they're telling me about my behavior, and I'm just kind of like, oh, of course, you're right, you're right, you're right. And I really at that point maybe had intended to try to curb it, but then they're coming at me more seriously, like, you're making a bad name for our family, our daughters see you, you're a bad example, da da da, we don't do things like that here in South America. And in my heart, I'm kind of thinking, oh, of course. You're just a little two-third world for me. I get it. I'm too stupid. But my words from my mouth of, oh, of course, you're right, you're right. And eventually it got to the place where they just weren't even putting up with it. They just had relented to the fact that I might die. And so I leave Venezuela. And I really kind of just thought, you know, I was so grateful to get out of there. I mean, it was two-third world. I mean, they were just too oppressive. They didn't understand me. I mean, my kind of sophistication, I need arts. I need 7-Eleven. You know, there were things that I needed in my life. And I mean, in reality, they were so grateful to get rid of me. I mean, really, you know, if I was going to die, it was going to be on their watch. And I wish I could say that I saw the pattern of getting to a place where my coping skills made it so shameful and so hard for me to face other human beings that taking a trip and becoming someone else was the only solution, and getting there and trying to not drink and become the person that I wanted to be, I would eventually have a mental blank spot, step off the curb, roll in the gutter, and find myself with a slew of consequences that left me leveled till I eventually got to the place where I needed to go again, you know? And I spent the next 20 years doing that. I went from Venezuela to San Diego to Denver to New York City, Miami, Frankfurt, Victorville, and then Pomona. My friend Marty in Los Angeles says that Victorville was the low, was the bottom. The women in Victorville, I spoke at a conference there, they love that. They just like go crazy. I'm Victorville. Each time I'm in a place, I'm there for like 2 years. I make friends. People, or at least I talk to people. I'm telling them what they want to hear. But I don't take any of the people I meet in one area to the next area because I'm convinced they know who I am. And they can't taint the well with the new people who I'm going to convince that I'm a good person, you know. And to some degree, maybe that was true. But mostly people weren't even paying attention. I didn't realize that till Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody's thinking about themselves. You know, they weren't even looking that closely. That's one of the things I love about Facebook. I got to be back connected with so many people and just share with them what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, what was going on and why I was so creepy. You know, if you're secreted and sullen and you don't talk to anyone, it's creepy to other people, you know? So my final last hurrah where I'd rallied the troops and I threw into fifth gear was in Pomona. I was going to get my degree, if it was going to kill me. I was up to 350 pounds. I had fuchsia hair, and I had constant chest pains. I was convinced. I was so angry when I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't. I was always a binge drinker, you know, where I would go for days at a time, but then be able to get the monkey off my back and function, you know, and just walk around just white knuckling it. And I did that through college. I got my degree in computer science and I got a big, big job and they threw tons of money that I wasn't qualified for at me. And there were so few of us and they weren't enough. The demand was greater than the supply. And I got my big first new fancy car and I was driving around with a six pack in the car. And I just remember thinking, I'm not going to try to stop anymore. You know, I had kind of a surrender to alcohol. I just broke. And within a year and a half, I was up to 2 cases of beer a day, where I would come to at 5 a.m. I'd start on the first case. We were talking about types of beer earlier. I'm a Bud Light drinker. I really wish I could change that part of history. But I would start off on the first case of beer, and it would maybe last till noon. And I'm walking around the apartment in 2, 3, 4 days worth of the same clothes. At any given point, they're covered in maybe remnants of vomit, urine, blood. And I don't really do anything. Play on the computer, drunk dial, maybe watch TV. I black out at around noon. I come to again around 5 p.m. I don't know if it's 5 a.m. or 5 p.m. I roll out of bed where the wet spot was and wonder who peed in the bed when I wasn't there. I maybe make it back to the kitchen. I start in the second case and I pray with everything in me that I can get through, you know, the second case after 6 a.m. Because if it happens before 6 a.m., we're in trouble. That's when the liquor stores open and that's when I start knocking on neighbors' doors. Thank you. And I called a cab one day because that's what I do. I call cabs. It was my way of my means of controlling and enjoying my drinking. It was one of the methods I had tried, and because I was convinced I was going to kill a small child, or something. It wasn't me I was worried about. It was having to live with having hurt you, and so I would call cabs, and I called a cab driver, and the guy who shows up is this dock worker kind of looking guy. He's 74. Flyaway white hair. He's rough. He's got like the really old school Navy tattoos, blue eyes kind of a thing. And he sees me in the doorway as he's coming to pick me up. And cab drivers, for those of you who are young, it was the predecessor to Uber. You would tell them where you were going. So he knew he was taking me to a bar. And so, you know, it was 11 in the morning on a Monday, crisp October day, where everyone else on the planet is working except for me. He sees me in the doorway at my house and he kind of is like, does this thing. And I'm thinking, he didn't even come to the door. Does he know who I am? Kind of a thing. I'm like, rude. So I get in the car and he starts talking about, you know, sober and sober and sober and sober. And I'm thinking, okay, because all right, you know, and he parks in the parking lot. And I remember him looking through the rearview mirror and just kind of going, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I flippantly said, I know I'm an alcoholic. I'm just not ready to do anything about it yet. But I'd never really said that word before out loud. And I remember looking at his expression, and I expected him to laugh because he seemed like he might be a drinker, right? He didn't laugh, but he also wasn't shocked like a normie. He just had our nod. And he looks at me, and then he starts handing me all of this literature, like I'm going to go home with a homework assignment when I'm on my way to a bar. He's like handing me, like, you know, the big book and the 12 and 12 and a potluck flyer and like some, like, his card and the meeting directory and all this stuff. The only thing I was willing to keep was his card, and after, you know, a couple more levels of incomprehensible demoralization, I called him. And he took me to my first meeting on a Wednesday night at the Rancho Cucamonga Alano Club, which is this tiny little club in Rancho Cucamonga where we rent space in a business park, you know, and you walk in there and it's kind of like it's the big room with a coffee bar and the lady that looks like she's been working there for 600 years, and it's got the popcorn ceiling and the linoleum floors and the metal folding chairs and then the donated long, like, looks like elementary school tables, but where the kids had chewed along the side and it was exposing particle board. And there's a podium, but it's like barely being held together with like duct tape. And there's an amateur painting of two hands playing, you know, like an acrylic thing someone had done. Two hands praying, just said, "We care." But like one of the fingers it just is not supposed to move that way. And there's a disco ball, because we're not glum. And then there's the 12 steps and 12 traditions. And it's got the smell of like that burnt Folgers coffee and cookies. And I loved you guys from the minute I got here. I mean, I loved you guys from the minute I got here. There was something about the fact that you knew who I was, and I was still allowed to be here. But there was like six people, and they were definitely people that did not mix. And, you know, Jim grabs my hand, and he starts marching me around the room, and he's just like, "This is Wendy. She's new. This is Wendy. She's new." And I get it. I'm with the deal. I've been through MLMs in college, kind of a thing. I know that what's happening is he wants to make sure everyone knows he's the one that gets credit for bringing the new recruit to your religion. Because I saw the word alcohol once and the word God about 70 million other times. And I felt like I'm Tom Hanks on the raft, you know, in Castaway. I'm getting on the boat. I don't care what you need me to say. You need me to talk in tongues. You need me to, like, you know, get dunked in a tank. You want me to get back? Let's go. I'm not going to mean it, but I'll show up and pretend I'm doing it, kind of a thing. And so for a long time, you know, I was just like listening and going to a lot of speaker meetings because I loved your stories. You told me the truth. And because the steps don't happen by, you know, just sitting in the meetings. They actually happen through action and us taking the actions we're suggested to take for those steps. I found myself back out then again within a year, you know, in a bar drunk, telling a bartender how important the ninth step is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I experienced my next bottom, you know, and I was in a hospital and getting banana bagged one more time, and the nurse didn't want to help me because I smelled so bad, and I just said that prayer. The prayer that I knew to say because I'd heard you people share it with me so many times, which was just, "God, I'm done. I'll do whatever it takes." And it was a decision step for me. I mean, I think the hardest step in Alcoholics Anonymous for me was step one. It took a long time to acknowledge the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body, the malady of spirit that I had, you know? I had to hear a lot of different people's experiences. And in step two, I don't know that I believed, but I was willing to believe at that point. And then it was just a matter of taking the actions and throwing my entire body in the ring. I am not going to fight this anymore, period. And seeking, you know, after I was in that hospital room, I called the women of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they cleaned me up, and they cleaned my house, and they got me to a detox in South Orange County. And I gotta tell you something, the miracle of all of this. I have been in South Orange County for 16 years now. The same place, the same people, the same bodies buried in the same spots, and people like me. You know, I really genuinely, with everything in me, threw myself into this thing. And I called my sponsor every day from that detox, and I said to her, I was like, you know, I don't know if this is really gonna work. I'm surrendered, I wanna do this, kind of a thing. I can just tell, though, the women here don't like me. And she said, "Tell them." So, I mean, I was in this meeting, Spiritual Giants, and I put it this way. I said, "My sponsor told me to say, because that helps. My sponsor told me to say that I don't think you guys like me. And the girl standing next to me grabbed my hand and she just said, I feel the same way. And that's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me all along with anything I'm going through. There is someone who's felt the same way. And that's where the isolation for me and the loneliness disappears. I know those feelings of separation, of less than or superior to, the inferiority complex with egomania, all of that, I'm not alone. I trust it completely. It's the only reason I have no problem sharing with you, because I know, well, not all of you, but most of you are just as sick as I am. Right, Kit? I have a good life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to just kind of run through the next few minutes. I got really busy. I threw myself in trying to be perfect. I was the chick that went to meetings, and I was just like, everything was rigid. And for about a year and a half, I made myself absolutely insane, trying to be perfect AA girl, trying to make this work faster than it was going to work. And I ended up in a hospital, a mental hospital, at a year and a half sober. My sponsor showed up that day. She sat right next to me, and there was a questionnaire. What do you hope to get from your hospital stay? She sat down and filled it out for me. and I just slept, and there was a break. There was definitely, you don't get to decide how quick this is going to happen, you know. You just got to go and do the next right action. And it was just, you know, the first big lesson of many big lessons. And I attended a lot of meetings. A lot of people in my area knew me. I confused notoriety with fame. And I started becoming like the world's biggest bleeding deacon in most of the meetings I went to. And people knew who I was, so I can figure they knew who I was, because I truly, that was my calling. I was meant to be a spiritual giant. And when you're a bleeding deacon the way I was, I mean, I'm still having suicidal thoughts, yet I want you to behave like I tell you to. And I got really involved in H&I. I got really involved in H&I because at the time, it was just such a broken moment for me at 3 years sober. I felt like they weren't going to turn me away from being of service. And sharing my story with women in jail or in mental hospitals or in any place, treatment, detox, whatever, it was a way to do it anonymously so my head didn't get crazy about it. When you're asked to speak at meetings like this, it's really easy. You know, you got the good wolf and the bad wolf. If really here, it's easy to feed into the bad wolf part of this, you know, which is I'm something I know. It's not of me, it's through me, you know. But there's something about getting involved in H&I that just makes it for fun and for free. And the power of that message just flows through you. And so it really saved my life at a very difficult time. And difficult because I made it difficult. And by 6 years sober, I was just kind of like AA everything. And a sponsor came into my life. And I've had 5 sponsors. I mean, I'm sure you all got one because you're really good at human relationships, but that's not my story. She started speaking all over the world. And so I would just go with her. You know, I had a good job because you guys told me to show up to work 15 minutes early because I'm grateful for having a job and then to work while I'm there and then to stay all day. And so I started following her around the world, and I hooked up with a group of kids in Europe who were starting a community called European Young Peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they asked me to be a part of their committee, and because I was going to carry the banner and to IKIPA in San Francisco. And before you know it, I'm involved in Young Peoples, and I'm 40 years old. And they said, you know what? If you've got room to grow, you're young. And I was like, okay. And I'm in the middle of like these dance circles and these huge convention halls that they have, and there's like 5 18-year-old boys dance around me going, Oppam Gangnam Style. I'm having a blast. You know, it was like the best time of my life. And the genuine first time I felt like I knew I wanted to live, I was 7 years sober. And the last thoughts of suicide I had, I was 9 years sober. The obsession to drink and use went away, but the thoughts of suicide were around for a very long time. Thankfully, I know that Bill had written a very similar letter to Central Office. It's at Akron. It just says, you know, I had those thoughts before. I don't have them anymore. And that kept me going for a long time. 10 years sober, I bought my first little house. And then at 11 years sober, I met him. Mm-hmm. Truly the love of my life. I am in Mexico. I'm at a wedding and I'm overextended and I don't want to be there, but I was taught to show up. So I show up, and as I'm coming home, the man puts him in my lap through the window in the car. He is a 1-pound terrier puppy by the name of Churro. I have no mental blank. I have mental blank spot. I have no defense against a little puppy. And I get him over here, and I'm thinking, I'll get him his shots. I'll do whatever I'm supposed to do. And I can't even tell you. I was convinced that I could never have a dog because it was going to take too much time away from AA. It was going to cost too much. And just like Alcoholics Anonymous, where I thought it was going to be too dull and there's never going to be a good life and I was never going to enjoy living without alcohol, it's proven me wrong in every step. In this respect, it has taken a lot of time and it has cost a lot of money, but the love that he's given me so outweighs the work. I did not know love on this level. And the same is true with Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know what it meant to have friends like I have today and the connections I have with people and what it means to walk hand in hand and say, I felt that way too. So thank you for letting me come out to share, guys.